Well, good morning. You know, trying to figure out as a guest speaker, how do I do it, is always a problem because you don't want to be too conspicuous, you know, with the way things are done. So there may be a few flaws, a few coughs because I'm still fighting a little chest thing. Fortunately, it's not COVID. But nonetheless, get along with that. I'm going to read a passage of Scripture, and it was mentioned beforehand, what is your Scripture? Well, the kind of thing I'm doing right now that Pastor Dean asked me to do isn't my normal way of doing things in church. This is more I usually do at some other kind of conference or you know, something like that, you know, a seminar or whatever. So this is going to be a little different. So I didn't really have a particular passage, but I thought about this one from Luke chapter 1. The writer Luke, who was not an eyewitness, which means that we all fit in the same classification. Remember the thinking of Peter in 1 Peter says, after he talked about everything, he says, you know, he says, you have not seen him, but you love him. And that's where we fit too. So that isn't true with most people. Luke says, inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. It seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully. He was a scholar, careful researcher, to write it out for you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the exact truth about the things you have been taught. This man was a scholar and a careful person, and he says, I have checked it out. And I talked to people who were there, and I got it all straight. And I made sure it was straight. I double-checked it. I cross-checked it. You know, he's that kind of guy. So, and that's sort of what we're talking about today, the question of Bible and archaeology. Now, that, again, is not what I usually talk about in the pulpit. But nonetheless, we're going to take four sessions and work through this. After about, I don't know, maybe 40, 50 trips to the Holy Land and various other countries throughout the Mediterranean, which would add up probably everything to about 100, I've really had an opportunity to see a lot of things. Matter of fact, my Visual Study Bible, the House Visual Study Bible, which some of you are using, that results from that because I'm trying to make the Bible understandable. And I had a missionary, for example, who contacted me from Papua New Guinea. He said, I love what you have. We can use this in teaching these people because they have so little context to understand the text. And that's true of many of us. So that's sort of what I like to do. And that's why I'm talking about archaeology, because actually being on site and seeing things and seeing what it does, what it says, how it fits into the story is the kind of thing that Luke would do. In other words, he would carefully study out all the components, put it together to make sense. And so that's what we're going to do today with the Bible and archaeology. You know, the first word is the Bible. That's our focus. Now, there's archaeology that's, you know, it's profitable. It's a scientific discipline, sort of like, you know, history or geology or something else. But it's on things that do not relate to the Bible. So my interest is, and that's where I do my archaeology when I do it, focuses on archaeology and the Bible. So we just call it biblical archaeology. And Dr. Randall Price and I put together a book on archaeology. I don't know if you've seen that yet. That's an area that I have been very interested in for years. Once you sort of see things of the Holy Land, you begin to put things together. So we're going to deal with archaeology only as it relates to the Bible, except for this first session, because what I'm going to talk about first, I want to give you a basic introduction to what is all this thing called archaeology. You see all the ologies, biology, zoology, you know, on and on and on. They have all the ologies, because that comes from Greek, logos, word, or sometimes translated study. And so it's a study of something. Study of life, bios, life, or Zoe, life, zoology, biology. This is a study of ancient things. And so it's a little different. We're going to work through then four different talks. Today is introduction. It's always good to get a basic structure. Am I wrong? Doing something wrong? Huh? Oh, I thought I was on. I thought what you told me. I'm up here talking. You got to tell me what I'm doing. Stop. I'm sorry. I guess I was supposed to read. You got to give me instruction.
That was my fault.
Okay. If I had thought a little bit more about it, I'd have probably figured it out. Thank you very much. Well, after that hiatus, let me come back. It's a good opportunity once again to introduce my wife right here on the second row. Raise your hand. Bye-bye. We were in town anyway bringing a friend. Hadn't known about this until toward the end, but bringing a friend to get on the airplane. But we, while we were here, we just took the time. Yesterday was our fifth anniversary. So that was January the 30th. So we're here sort of for that. What's today? Is it the 31st today? We get another day here? Okay. All right. We can do that again. Yeah, maybe let's call it a second. Okay. Well, listen, I was talking about last time the issue of the Bible and archaeology. And I'm emphasizing Bible because what I'm going to teach you today, not entirely, but largely, relates to any field of study, whether it be archaeology, the classical world, or, you know, Incan archaeology, maybe if you're going to go down south of here, or whatever, archaeology. Some of the same things there because it's a scientific discipline. But as it relates to what we're concerned about primarily, to understand more about the Bible and to confirm the Bible and to explain the Bible, these are the things we're going to learn in the next four sessions, okay? Have you ever heard someone get up and discuss this with you? Is this a newbie? Pretty new? Well, maybe that's why Pastor Dean wanted me to talk about it. So, again, it's not the context I usually use. But we're going to run through this on archaeology and history and the Bible. If I had six or seven sessions or so, I couldn't do 2 weeks in a row. We just are still unpacking and coursework. I'm teaching at four different doctoral programs right now at different universities, and it's sort of busy, but we're doing this week, and I would have done it a little bit differently by dividing the Old and New Testament some, and I have one I could do in archaeology and Jesus. I'm going to sort of put some all of this together, all right? So, we're going to look at an introduction to biblical archaeology, the components that it shares in common with other forms of archaeology. If you'll notice, you have, first of all, we need to look at a definition. We'll get into that. How it's divided up in disciplines. Like, you know, certain sciences have many different sub-sciences, you know, sub-divisions of them. The value of it, we'll basically hit on that very, very lightly because I'm going to talk about that more toward the end of the lectureship this week, all the way through next Sunday. Development of it. Steps in archaeology, what process do you use, and lastly, important finds. And there are some wonderful finds, more and more and more, and I'll talk about that. And it's amazing to me sometimes how many finds we do have in view of how many thousands of years we're talking about and cultures that have built on other cultures and other cultures, and it's just on and on and on. How do you get down to that period? And we're going to discuss how you do that. But actually, with the issue of archaeology, it's sort of like in the study of ancient textual criticism and the manuscripts of the Old Testament and New Testament. You know, I started out as a classicist and studying in the area of Greek and Latin and things of that sort. And classical scholars are really happy if they can get a half a dozen manuscripts historically that haven't been destroyed, that they actually have manuscripts of some famous author like a Plato or Aristotle. The only thing that in that classical world that really there's a plethora of are the works of Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey. They've got about 900 of those they've located. Plato, you have two. And yet they believe their manuscripts are valid and valuable and represent what was written. I could go through others. I'm not going to do all of that. But the point of it is, there is very little that we know from the ancient world in the writings. Except in the Bible, we have in the New Testament around 6,000 manuscripts and 10,000 translations in the same period. Our problem is not the dearth of evidence. Our problem is we've got so much we don't know what to do with it. Same thing is true in the Old Testament. We used to just have a little bit until the Dead Sea Scrolls, and all of a sudden now it's more and more and more. The Bible is a very substantiated document, and we as Christians, and I don't think you're going to hear something like this in a lot of churches today. They'll be too busy doing other things that have nothing to do with the Bible. But if you're in a place where you really want to understand something, you realize that we are blessed and we have the opportunity to be further researchers of the Word ourselves, like the Bereans who check it out. And that's what you ought to do. You ought to check me out. You ought to check anybody out. If you can check out the Apostle Paul, you can check out anybody, right? So that's important, that we all be scholars in our own right of a sort. In other words, people who are diligent like a Luke, all right? So be sure and do that. So we're going to talk about all these things. So let's look at the definition of archaeology first, if you're taking notes. If not, I think this is being recorded. Is that correct? And you can look at it later and you can go back through it. This is like taking a basic class in Introduction of Archaeology at a university. Sort of like that, really. Archaeos and logos. I've already said that. It's a study of ancient things. Arche is a word which means beginning. Sometimes the word in another form means ruler, but I won't go into that. And I'll show you examples of that in archaeology when it's used of the mean ruler. But here it means beginning or first. This is the first portion of the Bible. In the beginning, you know, Bereshit bara Elohim. In the beginning, God created. So it's in the beginning. Or the same concept that we have with even in the New Testament with Jesus. Logos is obviously reference to word, but it also means study of. So it means a study of ancient things. Now, one British archaeologist used it a little differently. He said it's a study of durable rubbish. Now, that doesn't spin it too well for me. There's a sense in which that's true, because it's all those things that are under feet of many feet sometimes. They usually don't lie all the great archaeology on the surface where you just pick it up as you go around. I mean, you've got to dig for it, like a lot of things in life. You really want to get something good, you dig for it, and you have to dig. And I'll show you about that, how it works. But durable rubbish, yeah, I don't like it. But Irene and I were in Jerusalem and working at the archaeological collection site, I guess I should say, of Gabi Berkai, who's a good friend of ours. Gabi Berkai is probably the number one archaeologist in Israel. Sharp guy, wonderful history, and I wish I had time to talk about him. He can just talk all day long about everything. But what happened is that the Islamic Waqf, the leadership on the Temple Mount among the Muslim world, they decided they wanted to have another, because they hadn't got enough up there yet, they wanted another mosque, and they put it underground so they can stay out of the weather, you know. And they didn't get permission to do this, but they did it anyway. And they dug out about 500 or 600, I can't remember how many it was, it's like that, maybe 700, truckloads of rubbish from underneath the Temple Mount. And they dropped it all in the Valley of Hinnom, Gehenna, the Valley of Hinnom, the Valley of Refuge, or rubbish, as it were. And they just threw it out there. Well, what Gabi did, he says, well, this isn't the way you like to do archaeology. You always try to do everything in what they call in situ. That is, you do it at the place it occurs, and I'm going to show all this to you in a minute. You mark everything. I mean, when we do archaeology, everybody, they give you something not even as big as this platform, and they say, this is your area today, and you start digging and looking for things, and if you find anything, you hold your hand up, yell and scream, and somebody comes and takes a picture of where you found it, what it is, marks it there, get it all done, catalogs it, puts it away, takes it away from you, and then you're on your way. You don't get to keep these things. And so it's very carefully done. Well, here they have entire mounds of almost 700 truckloads of stuff from underneath the Temple Mount that goes all the way back from the time of Abraham, at least, until the time of the Ottoman Turks and later. I mean, this stuff has developed over a long period of time. They have found things, even Islamic finds that have been helpful to Muslims who want it, and they're very open to share things like that. But it's great viewpoints that you find. So it is rubbish in a sense, even like in the when you do the collecting, they take it all to a special place and everybody sifts through everything. Now, you're not doing it in situ, which is unfortunate. But they have found all sorts of wonderful finds from all different periods over 3,000 or 4,000, 5,000 years. Okay? Now, to continue on, though, I like this better. It is the systematic recovery, analysis, and interpretation of the surviving evidence of human activity. That sounds better to me than rubbish. But nonetheless, this is what you're trying to do when you do archaeology. Now, there are divisions of archaeology. They focus on different things. One deals with artifacts themselves, like lamps. That's an artifact. And believe it or not, some of these kinds of things are very valuable, particularly for dating and for movement around the empire. In other words, when they have actually got this thing to a science where they have a computer, and I don't even claim to understand this, not even close. But they've actually been able to figure out where the clay came from all the clay you find in Israel as far as these kinds of pieces of rubbish. You know, they can trace this all the way through the empire, and they know where this came from, where it shipped from. It's sort of like us, you know, deal with international trade. And you can figure out these things. You can figure out not only how old they are. So even the little things like lamps, which these are sort of like a dime a dozen, unless it really is a good one that goes back a long ways. I've got a few that are I wouldn't give up, but they're real ones. But nonetheless, they help to understand the people, the customs, the time, and all those things, which are all valuable pieces of information. So you can't just disassociate things. You have to put it's like a puzzle. You have to put things together. And if you're missing a puzzle piece, have you ever done puzzles? I've done puzzles. And you can't find that piece that fits here. It makes it difficult to figure out what you're looking at. Right? And that's true with a lot of stuff like this. They may seem insignificant, but they actually prove to be quite valuable. Okay? So sometimes you have artifacts. We'll talk more about that. Other times you have what are called inscriptions. Now, here's the way archaeologists look at it. If they can find a writing, I don't care if it's three letters, if they can find a writing on something ancient, that takes precedence in their mind. Because it's from the writing, the intellectual communication of humans, that provides the best information. I'm going to show you examples of that. Sometimes the writings are lengthy, like I'm going to here you have the black obelisk of Shalmaneser. Well, see, this is important for our understanding of the ancient world in reference to Babylon and so forth. But there are others that are just very minor, I'm going to show you, nonetheless, that connect to the Bible. Particularly if it's the name of someone, I'm going to show you something fairly recent. They found the only example of a Hebrew king inscribed on a bulla, they're called. And these little things, about the big as a maybe a quarter, has the name of Hezekiah, which is an 8th century king, right? He was the Assyrian king. Sennacherib thought he was going to come in and take over Jerusalem. And the next morning he woke up after Hezekiah prayed and God and him sort of got things straight. And the next morning he woke up with his entire army dead. It's hard to fight a war when you haven't got an army. I can imagine what was going through this guy's head. Uh-oh, I better get out of here. And he did. And he headed, what is all the army, but what about 185,000 people? That's good. That's enough to put a dent in the war. And went back and his sons killed him in the temple. But it's all written in there about this whole issue of Hezekiah. When he says, I came to Hezekiah, this is the Jerusalem, the plum. He said, I came to Hezekiah after conquering all the little cities around Hezekiah, including Lachish, which is a major city next to Jerusalem. He conquered it, and he was going to conquer Jerusalem. He had a powerful army, all sorts of battering rams and different things to get in. It was the major power of the world at that time. And he says, I hedged up Hezekiah like a bird in a cage, and then I went home. Now, you know, something happened. You don't waste all your time to conquer all the places around and then come to the plum and say, you know, I'm sort of tired of war. You guys want to go home? It's about lunchtime. You know, and head off. God put an end to his adventures, and we know about it. From the Bible, it makes all the sense in the world. Aren't these fun pieces of information? They'll help you to understand the text, even just what I've said so far. What is going on in the text? Archaeology can help you understand that, particularly if you can find an inscription that has a lot to say, fills in data. Okay, moving on. And here's another example of an inscription. Now, this goes back to the time when you had the Roman army come into Israel. In AD 70, they conquered Jerusalem, and they overthrew the walls. By the way, if you read Jesus' words very carefully, some people read, I read one well-known scholar of New Testament studies at Oregon State University who was talking about how Matthew and Luke contradicted each other, demonstrating the errors that occur in the Bible. He says, because Matthew has Jesus born in a house, whereas Luke has Jesus born in a stable. And then I thought, does this guy ever read? A guy who brings his family in because of dire situations, takes a lowly place for the birth, doesn't stay around for 7 or 8 months staying around there with the cows. He goes and finds, I know this myself, we've been living in a farmhouse for 2 months. What an adventure. I know more about cows now than I ever want to know. We see them lined up at the fence, wanting in. And every time we try to go out, we got to fight them off to get out. Imagine if I had to fight them, it's moving, they just scatter. But I've learned a lot about them. They can outstare you. Now, the fact is, though, that you don't stay in a place like that when you've got a wife and a new child, and you're talking about 7 or 8 months later when the Magi come in, because they don't come in. You know, in my Christmas scenes, I always put my manger here, and I put my little, you know, all the people, the shepherds and the animals and so forth, and then I put the three Magi over here because they got to travel for several months to get there, and we got them at the same place for some reason. But you don't keep your wife and child there. What do? He's a carpenter. He's a builder. He found a job. He has family. He moved out. He got a home. So Matthew's not talking about the birth scene. See, it's Luke who's discussing that. And the guy wouldn't read it carefully enough to know the difference. Isn't that terrible? And make these kind of claims. Well, anyway, the point is the Romans came in, and Jesus in Matthew chapter 24, when he talked to his disciples, he said this. He said, because they came up and said, oh, Jesus, aren't these wonderful buildings on the top of the Temple Mount? Aren't they wonderful? Remember, read the text. It actually says that. The buildings on top of the Temple Mount. And there were lots of them. Solomon's portico, the temple itself, other things. And he says, not one stone shall be left on, and he's talking about the buildings, not one stone shall be left on top of another. He wasn't talking about destroying the entire walls of all the city. He was talking about the buildings on the top, and there were none left, right? By the way, the kind of stone they use, a limestone to build these things with, burns very well. And that's why it burns and crumbles. And then they pushed all over portions of the walls and left the remainder. See, reading carefully is important. Now, we look in the archaeology. This is an example. Somebody, when they were knocking down the walls, knocked the top portion of the western portion of the wall, and when they knocked that off, this fell to the ground, and they uncovered it in recent days. Okay? I was there in about 1990-something when I was with the guy who was doing the excavation of this place on what is called the Western Wall area, the Southwestern Wall where you have, they found a lot of shops and all sorts of stuff. That you could actually, I always used to tell my people on tours, Today we're walking where Jesus walked, 30 feet above. Because that's the truth, is down there. But when you're at the southwestern wall, you can say you are stepping on the steps that Jesus almost for sure stepped on. It's the same level of the first century. See, it's a little difference. And so this came to the bottom as they uncovered all these many stones that would fill this room and more. They found this, the place of the trumpeting, which was the place they would take the shofar and they would blow at the beginning and ending of feasts and other kinds of holy days and so forth. That's what this was. And they had a special place on the southwestern wall at the top where they did this. And this was knocked over by the Romans. That good? This is an example of an inscription, very important. Even Josephus talks about it in his work, Jewish War. Another example is Atarhashis, his epic. I don't know if I said that. Atarhashis. Okay, the Babylonian story of the flood. Now, this is only one of the stories. There are other stories that talk of the creation. And this is of the flood. And you also have another one that's called the Gilgamesh epic. Same thing, discussing the flood. And the flood stories and the creation stories are interesting. I was with a guy that I really didn't know that well, but we walked around several years ago at a Society of Biblical Literature meeting, which is sort of where mainly more liberal elements of scholarship go to, but a large number of evangelicals also attend. And he and I were walking around, and he was telling me about the fact, can you believe that people, in reading the stories of creation in Babylon, Assyria, and other places, as well as the works of the flood, don't understand that the Bible simply copies these things? And my argument to him was, well, you know, there are a lot of similarities between these two. I agree. I really do think they are a number of similarities. But I think they used a common source, and these got some of it wrong, and the Bible got the rest right. So we have a different view. In other words, I do think there was a common story that Adam and those after him picked up, maybe from God himself or however it happened, but they began to pick up stories of the creation. And, of course, later on, we have the flood with Noah and what was picked up there. And what they call the family histories in the Bible, sometimes the genealogy of this person, the genealogy of this person, that's actually a Hebrew word, toledot, which means a family record. That's what the term means, a family record, a history. You keep your all about your family. Well, they went back, each one of them, and moved their pedigree down and all the things that happened. That's how you get those stories in the Old Testament. And so what happened is that I think that they borrowed from a common account. See, Moses, I think the family histories were passed down through the Jewish people all the way through Abraham, all the way to Moses, ultimately. And that's the source. The other issue is this. And this is what I teach when I teach the area of hermeneutics, the idea of interpretation. How do you understand what meaning is? And how do you discern meaning? And here it is. Similarity is not the same thing as sameness. Things can be similar and yet not be the same. That's why it's not uncommon. When Paul got ready to write a letter, I don't think he said, I'm going to create a new way of writing. I'm going to do it differently than anybody's ever done it. I'm going to start a new group, a new fad or something. No, he used what people used to be understood, right? Think about it today. Dear John, right? Dear John, comma. Or to whom it may concern if you're writing a business letter. We have these forms we use. Is that correct? And then we usually write our statement. We used to start off with something interesting. How are you? You know, it's a personal letter. Dear so-and-so, how are you? How's it been going? I heard about that. You know, just some basic information. And then you might write something and you end up, sincerely yours or yours truly or love or whatever you're going to say. We have forms, do we not? If you find forms together, does that mean you copied each other? They look identical almost, right? Well, some of the things do look identical. It's the literature, it's a genre that you use to be understood as what you're writing. Does that make sense? You don't write, for example, a business letter, you know, love John or love Mary to the attorney or something, you know. No, you have words you use and forms you use. Well, I guess you could if you were married. But the point of it is there are forms you use that are understood by us all. But similarity does not mean it's the same thing and they borrow necessarily. Does that make sense? The same thing happens in the biblical text. You have the temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem built by Solomon, correct? Formerly the tabernacle up in Shiloh. Formerly before that in the desert and other places. So you have this piece of literature, or you have the information that has similarities. You have temple here, temple here, temple here, all the way through the world. Man, you know what they do? In the ancient world, both in Greece and Egypt, you go to all these places, they built their temples high on a mountain, just like they do with Israel. Why would you do that? Because the people look up to it. They go up to it. It has a symbolism to it. Why would you, for example, have a temple? That's where the God dwells. Now, and we have Yahweh, the God of Israel, has no dwelling point because of he's omnipresent. But guess what? He had a representation even in the temple of the Ark of the Covenant and the two angels and the presence of the Shekinah glory, those things. So we find similarities, sacrifice sites. Just because you follow similar ideas, you don't look at what the similarities are. You look at what are the differences, though. The differences indicate the lack of plagiarism, as it were. De-emphasizes those kind of things. So all these stories are great for us. They give us information. This is from Nineveh, the Gilgamesh. It's a fascinating story, which I can't take the time to go into, or I'll never even get through the next slide. But it's a fascinating story, but it's not identical to the Noahic story. You look at what are the differences, not just what the similarities are. Now, here's one I promised you. All these inscriptions, usually you like a lot of writing. But you don't need a lot here. This is something they found at a place where you have just one basic statement about a person's name, Goliath. Now, I'm trying up here as I'm talking. Oh, yes, he was at Gath, which is not too far from the Valley of Elah, which is where David fought him. This is not the Goliath of the Bible, almost for certain. There are reasons for that. But it's important to see as a piece of history and archaeology, because it demonstrates that that name talked about in the Bible was well used in the ancient world. So it would not be unreasonable to say that the Bible, Goliath, you know, is borrowing a similar kind of name. We do the same thing with Theophilus in Luke chapter 1. Luke 1 talks about most excellent Theophilus. That's the only place you see that word. But you know what? I was at a place in Turkey, ancient Asia Minor, and I discovered it on a monument, a column, Theophilus. And I thought the name was in use. See? So these are the kinds of things you find. And it's small but important. Well, anyway, value of archaeology. Frequently illustrates and illuminates the Bible. It may assist in determining fixed dates for biblical events, for example, the patriarchs, the Exodus, and so forth. It also may clear up the interpretation of obscure texts, and this is an example here. What is the Bible talking about when it talks about the horns of the altar? Remember the guy who actually rebelled against Solomon? They were trying to take the king. He went and grabbed the horns of the altar, and Solomon said, go down and get him. He said, no, he's holding on to the horns. Refuge. Solomon said, forget it. Go down and get him. he hasn't got any refuge right now. David said to him, listen, he said, I've been hanging on to these guys for a long time. You better get rid of them at the first. And so Solomon sent down, and they pulled him from the horns of the altar. And these are what we mean by the horns of the altar. A lot of examples in the ancient world. Most of them are smaller, but this is a really big one. By the way, this is a replica, but the original is in the Israel Museum. And this is what they look like. So when you see horns of the altar in the Bible, now when you see this, what? You know what it's talking about. That's what I try to do, is try to help people understand how things connect and visually represent that. It frequently illustrates and illuminates the Bible. It may assist in those things, but also this. It can contribute information concerning customs and cultures. For example, the Bible talks often about city gates. It often talks about the Canaanites. It even talks about the Philistines. Here's a good one for you. The Philistines, that word is referring to a seafaring people that came to the western shore of Israel. They established themselves there, and they had certain abilities that the Israelites didn't have at the time, the chariots, the iron, some of the things like that, which made them quite formidable. They were Greeks. That's what they were. And you find people doing that in the ancient world. Ever heard of Hannibal? Hannibal was above Israel there, where Jezebel came from. He took also a trip, and he went over to North Africa to a place called Carthage. And he was a big player there. I read all the works of Hannibal. I thought they were fascinating about the battles with Rome. And about he went on to Spain, then went on to Rome. Never actually came to the city gates. They would say, Hannibal at the gates. Hannibal, he never made it. He's always up in the north. But all these peoples went around different places. The Philistines are Greeks. And that, it sort of amused me when Arafat, trying to find their pedigree about the Palestinians, he said, we're the ancient Philistines. They're not Greek. The Philistines were Greek. So Arafat didn't have a drop of Greek blood in him. He just made it up as he went. And the idea of Philistia and Philistine is what they call Latinized or Romanized into the words Palestine and Palestinian. See, those words have no truth historically in reference to the Philistines at all, which is where it came from. Those were done by Hadrian at AD 135 when he came in as the emperor of Rome and demolished Israel at the time, which is another story in itself. But we find out information about these things. It can help us to correct misinterpretations. By the way, the text of Scripture only has one meaning. It doesn't have multiple meanings. It has one meaning. But it has many interpretations. And you know that from all the different viewpoints. But an interpretation of meaning is not the same thing. You can seek to interpret the meaning. The question is your interpretation consistent with what the meaning is? And that's what we try to deal with. It often supplements the information given in the Bible. For example, details missing in the biblical accounts like Sargon II, King Mesha of Moab. By the way, this right here is the Moabite stone, also called the Mesha stone. This has the name of Yahweh written on it in Moabite. Also has the name of David found on it, King David on it, which made it very valuable as an artifact and an inscription. And there are others that I've given you here that I'll just keep moving. Sometimes authenticates the Bible, destroyed false theories, like the documentary hypothesis has really been. When I was doing study back in the Dark Ages, years and years and years ago, I studied the documentary hypothesis. Now, I did it as a conservative, but I did have to understand what they're saying. That view has been exploded. And some try to tenaciously continue to hold on to it, whereas in reality they haven't got much going for them. And one of the things that has destroyed them is we found out more about certain archaeological and manuscript concerns. Those things have pretty well done away with most of the liberal view on the fragmentation of Scripture. You know, that you just had bits and pieces that somebody grabbed and glued together. That's sort of gone anymore. False theories that relating to the Bible, archaeology has helped on. Also demonstrates the accuracy of the Bible. For example, the Solomonic Gates. I wish I had time to talk about all these things, but we'll go into some of it this week. They found that Solomon, when he came in, he created in different places of the country what would be called military bases. One over one of the passes, what we call the Valley of Jezreel, Jezreel, and also we call the Valley of Megiddo, Armageddon, see? Okay. So we have that. Then you have one down south, and then you have one also a place called Hatsor. These were military sites, and what we found out is that they all had the same architect at the same period of time, thus. They, not different people. They follow the exact same procedure, and I'll show you that in a minute. The Hittites are an interesting one. I had the opportunity to go to northern Turkey a few years ago by myself. I just went up there to look. Because scholars used to argue the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, that the Hittites never existed. Now, there's almost 50 references to the Hittites in the Bible, but scholars said these are made-up people. You know, they're like orcs, you know, or something, you know, Middle-earth people or whatever, men from Mars, or I don't know. But these Hittites in the Bible are made-up people. And so that was believed until the very end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, when some guy stumbled across a place that had about 30,000 manuscripts written by the Hittites. And that theory just went down the tubes. It's like that guy who wrote a book in 1948 in the early spring of 48. I actually had to look hard to find a copy of this. They're not easy to find. I got a real one. He said that the Bible teaches the Jews will never be restored to their land. And just a few months after that, they were declared a nation. His book just torpedoed, you know, down. That was it was not a bestseller. And so, you know, you got to be careful about this information, you know. So you're saying the Hittites never existed, and then they found Hattusha and found out that not only do the Hittites exist, they were a major nation of the world like the Babylonian Assyria. And we know more about Hittites now. I have a friend, Harry Hoffner. He's with the Lord now. I wish I could tell you stories he told me. He actually used to dream in Hittite. But he was a Hittiologist at University of Chicago in many other languages. And there's a commentary series of which I'm the general author, a general editor. And he wrote the volumes on Samuel. Brilliant work. And Hoffner, he knew Hittite like the back of his hand, maybe as good as English. And this thing never existed, supposedly. Scholars had to eat what they call crow when they made these statements. But the Bible really, and archaeology together, really do a lot of great things. Pontius Pilate, I'll get to that. Sodom, I've been digging at Sodom. And Arena started digging with me 3 or 4 years ago, I guess right after I got married, across from Jericho. Across the Jordan River, a great place. You can do it, too. I've been talking about, Pastor Dean and I talked about, maybe we should get together and go do a dig at Sodom. Maybe some people might want to go and spend a week or so and see what it means to do archaeology. That'd be fun. Plus, you get a look at all the stuff in Jordan. It's great stuff. Here's an example of the Solomonic Gates. Three cities, all with the same structure. This is unique new structure. And you all of a sudden see three of them, Hazor, Gezer, and here at Megiddo, Tel Megiddo, where Armageddon, you know. So that's that. And then you have something like this, where we'll get to in a little bit on the what is called the Pontius Pilate inscription. You know where they found this? At a staircase in Caesarea by the sea, somebody had put in to walk on pieces of stairs. And somebody was looking one day and saw, I think I see writing. And the archaeologists then get all excited. And the world, you know, these just like a swarm of locusts into that. You know, and all of a sudden they found a great thing, has everything you need. I'll talk about it later. Can't do too much now. Here's what Nelson Gleck says. Gleck, before he was killed in a wadi in Israel when the rushing waters surprised him and overtook him, he was a very, very famous archaeologist, a Jewish man. And he said this. He said it may be stated categorically that no archaeological discovery has ever controverted a biblical reference. This is not your fundamentalist. This is a well-known Israeli archaeologist. He actually wasn't from Israel. He was elsewhere. But he was a rabbi and a Jew. Scores of archaeological findings have been made which confirm in clear outline or exact detail historical statements in the Bible. That's a great statement. So we have some ways in which this began to happen. There were some early interests in archaeology, but very little as we look to its history. Largely, people were looking for things like relics, sites that were biblical sites like the Church of the Holy, you know, where was Jesus born, where did he die, where was he raised from the dead, you know, where was Abraham, where was Rachel. They were looking for just a few odds and end things. They really were not looking. These were things that became important, like in the 4th century when Christianity became the official religion, those things. But over time, pilgrims began to come to Israel. Of course, in the 7th century, the Muslims took over, so that posed some problems, which ended up bringing in the Crusades to fight for the pilgrims and the people living there over against the Muslims. A lot of people misrepresent this, by the way. You know, a lot of people say, all these Christians came in trying to kill Muslims. You ought to read some stories on that, some real history before you start talking that way. A good book on this issue is Rodney Stark, Baylor University, a phenomenal historian. So actually, some more of a social historian. And a great book on the issue of the Crusades. It puts it in proper historical perspective. But nonetheless, the pilgrims started coming, the Crusades, and all the way up until after the period of the Enlightenment had begun, as they call it. Then you have treasure hunters coming in. Can you imagine that? People who would come in looking for treasure, and graves especially. The Valley of the Kings in Egypt. By the way, I want you to know I wore my Egyptian tie today just because of speaking on archaeology. That in the Valley of the Kings, where they have, I don't know how many, 70 tombs maybe the kings or more. I'm not an Egyptologist per se, really. I can't remember exactly how many. And they keep finding them. Everyone were pillared. They went in and took everything. We are so impressed by King Tut, a very young king, very young, had barely got going when he died. And you see all this beautiful gold and jewels and chariots. Man, isn't that wonderful? No, this guy didn't hardly live at all enough to collect anything. You can imagine the ones who lived 30, 40 years, how much they collected over that period of time that went into their tombs. He was a poor king in comparison. It's just that nobody ever found out where, because he was buried underneath another pharaoh. And they thought they had pillaged everything, and they hadn't gone deep enough. And he survived. He didn't survive. His treasures survived. So anyway, treasure hunters came in like everything. Then you have scientific studies that came in with a number of people that I'll not go into. But Dame Catherine Kenyon is one of the major ones. But there have been some really great. John Garstang, who found Jericho. Catherine Kenyon, who did it and disagreed with Garstang. She was wrong. And then you have Bryant Wood, who came in after her at Jericho. And I think he's right. He went back to Garstang. He said, this is archaeology going on. But they're forming a scientific approach to doing it. And this is really key, and I think you'll see some of that in a minute. Modern archaeology to the present. What are the steps of archaeology? First of all, you have to find the location. Now, you got a little to choose from. You can start, for example, you can start in western Greece and just go right over east as far as you want to go through Babylon all the way to Ur of Chaldees and into Persia. And you got a lot of land to pick from to do your archaeology. Can you see the problem? You can go to a site that's not any bigger than what this building is right now. Matter of fact, this room. And you can spend 20 years. Because you do not have what is needed to uncover the whole world of archaeology. And I'll show that to you in a minute. That's unfortunate because it's all there. It's inside the rubbish heap, so to speak. But you got to get to it. One thing. You have to have scholars. Why? Because you got to be able to read ancient languages. Moabite, Phoenician, Punic, Egyptian, Ammonite, Canaanite. I've actually studied some of these. I studied Ugaritic, which is the Canaanite language, the Moabite language. I studied the Phoenician language, Aramaic, Hebrew. You got to learn. But I don't know hardly anything. There's some guys who know a lot. And Robert Dick Wilson knew about 40 ancient languages fluently. I don't even get close. I'm a pauper. But, you know, you have to know a lot in language because you've got to be able to read what you come to. Also, you have to have certain skills. You have to know a little bit about geology and architecture. You've got to know a lot of stuff. And so you don't have that many people that you can find willing to. Because it's not a lucrative business. They don't let you keep the treasure. They'd probably get more people if they say, whatever you find, you can take home. Sell to somebody. But you got to give it up. And so it's not lucrative. Well, you have to find somebody to finance you. Oftentimes universities do it because they have finances. Anybody ever been to Ephesus? Anybody? We've got to take you guys on a trip. I do this all the time. Ephesus. That has been, for more than 100 years, it has been financed by several schools like Princeton, Harvard, I don't know, different ones, that have gone in there with students and archaeologists and have had donors to help them uncover it. Otherwise, you wouldn't see this wonderful city now. You know, it's really been uncovered a lot. Not entirely, but a lot. And there was a place called Laodicea. You ever heard of that? I was in 1996 in Laodicea with two people and the guide. And we got there in our van. It wasn't a big tour or anything. And I said, "Where's the city?" He said, "It's out there." "Where?" And I got out and started looking around, and I started kicking some stones and looking, and I saw, oh, this seems to be a theater. This is not a coliseum. It's a theater, amphitheater. And because I can see certain stones in different places, and I begin to put it together. Well, a guy who had a business there, he recognized, somebody sold him on the idea, if you actually help finance this place where it really becomes cool, where people really want to go to, that they'll come to your shop after they've been looking at this place. And so he began to put money into it, and they finally got stuff going. And now if you go to Laodicea, it is one of the best preserved and revealed sites in the entire Asia Minor area. It's phenomenal. It just took people giving money, and you had to collect scholars. See, that's what has to happen. You got to find the location, though. You can't go everywhere. You got to look for specific places. You got to step on a stone or something and say, "Oh, something's here." Otherwise, it's way down there. So, you go to what are called tales. Now, I've given you different spellings here. You've heard of Tel Aviv, Tel Aviv. Everybody, Tel Aviv. Okay. There's Tel Aviv, Tel Megiddo, Tel Dothan, Tel this, Tel that. Tel is a word that means a mound, a hill, not a mountain, it's sort of a mound that individual civilizations have built up. They didn't get rid of stuff like we do. Our view of something happens, you just bring in the bulldozers, scrape everything off, throw it away somewhere, and start over. No, they always use what was there already. It's hard to carry stone around. They use what was there already, they try to build up with it, and they just built on their sites, and they kept getting bigger. The site of Megiddo, and I don't have it in my head or I would tell you the facts, but the site of Megiddo has something like, I don't know, 20 to 30 civilizations over the years that's built up on top of it. And so you have these artificial mounds. So Tel Aviv is a spring. It's the mound of the spring. And so they have the city named after this place that actually was a city, a small city at the time. Remember, Jericho is Tel Jericho, but that only held a few hundred people. We think of Jericho as big. It's a few hundred people there. You got this big army marching around it, and you got about maybe 300 or 400 people sitting inside looking. Whereas Tahamam, across the way that we've been doing it, probably had 10,000 people, very major. Part of it had to do with the fact they had underground springs that watered the whole area. And that brings people in, see. So Jericho is just a wasteland. It's very much of a desert. So you have this. Now, Tel and Tel is a separate spelling. People do it different ways. But in Jordan, which is the only place in the world, to my knowledge, in Jordan, they don't use the word Tel. They use the word Tal. So T-A-L and the Arabic in Jordan. Everybody else uses Tel. Here, Joshua, let Israel... Yet Israel did not burn any of the cities on their mounds except Chazor, which Joshua burned. See, and they use the word there. Here's an example of it. Tel Bet Shean, also known as Scythopolis, the place that the sons of Saul was hung on the walls of here. Where? Up here at the Tel. Below is Scythopolis, the ancient Alexandrian city that was built when Alexander conquered, what became called the diaspora, the cities, the 10 cities of the Greeks, which Alexander started and the Romans continued. So the lower city is later Greek. The upper state here is ancient Bethshean. Okay? That's what happened there. Tell Megiddo, major site, looking from the top. You have Tel Dothan, another one. That's out in the area of where close to Gezer and so forth. Tel Jericho, I put in two different ones. This is a more an older photo. This is a newer one, just to give you. Below there, they have the shops and so forth you can go to, and the best lamb chops of any place I've ever eaten. I actually used to drive from Jerusalem down to Jericho just to eat lunch, because the lamb chops are great if you go. Tel Lachish, the second city next to Jerusalem. A very important site. I got a whole story on that someday if you want to hear it. Tal El Hammam. This is where we've been digging. Major, major site. A kilometer by maybe 3/4 of a kilometer in size. They found some phenomenal things there. Now, what they do is create a cross-section of a tal or tel. You have the mound, and then you got to figure out what are you going to figure out of it. You got to you can't dig it all up. That'd be wonderful, but you can't. It would take too much money. I mean, Bill Gates could finance it, but it would take hundreds of people for several years to get all this done. So what they've done is they create a cross section of it, like you might have human remains at certain levels, just individual rocks at others, walls at others, mixtures at other places. As you dig down and you're recording all of this, you find all sorts of things to look at. And Tel Hammam, probably, at least in my opinion, probably the most likely site for ancient Sodom. And there's some reasons for that, but we can't talk about them right now. Why do people live in the same place? Why don't they go elsewhere? I mean, you conquer a place, why don't you go somewhere else? Because there's a reason why they are there. Every civilization has a reason to be at that place. What? You go where there's water. It's not plenteous. You find a place that's defensible. If you're high with a wall, you're more defensible than if you're just out on the plain. By the way, see, we might still have walls today, except we have ways to knock them down too easy. Or you just fly over them and shoot down. Walls wouldn't do any good in warfare today. But in the ancient world, they're very important. Arable land, somewhere to grow crops. Commercial links. For example, Megiddo is there. One reason why is because it's on a whole pathway down to the Mediterranean Sea. And it goes right through the land. You have about, oh, I don't know, several miles one way and the other way that you have caravans and commercial activity going on. So that's why you build something there. It could be that you just simply have previous city with the building supplies allowed. You know, they left them for you when you conquered them. And then maybe other reasons might be connected to it too. So why would you leave then? Famine or plague? Or maybe the judgment of God. You know, fiery little meteorites hitting you. So that's probably what happened. A meteorite shower sort of takes you out and everybody leaves permanently. Earthquakes sometimes, several cities. Matter of fact, Scythopolis in the 7th century had a major earthquake that occurred throughout the Mediterranean world. And that's one of the things that destroyed the city. So I mean, things like that take place. Are things like, for example, at, in Italy, the volcano, Vesuvius, yeah. So these are all kinds of things that make you leave and decline, and it declines the local economy. So these are the steps. Now, I realize my time is running out, and I talk too much. But there's so many wonderful things to discuss here, and I just keep going. But that's me. Where's all the treasure they said was here when I was digging? This is at Tel Hammam. And so you begin to form different ways to do your work. And I'm going to just go here to show you some of the quick things. You break into little groupings, little squares, and you do your work there. You make all your records there, take all your photos there, keep track of every single detail while you're there. And then I'm going to move past some of this. That's probably more than you need. You keep very careful records on sheets. You have records that you built up over time where you can compare with and say, what is this? Well, it fits into this one or that one. You put tags on all the pottery to be sure you keep track of it. And then you draw these floor plans out, because the problem is sometimes when you're doing archaeology at one site, you're actually destroying another site below you. And you have to make decisions on what you do and keep track of it. You draw pictures of all these things. This is the kind of stuff that's done. One thing is sort of fascinating. This right here, styles change, don't they? These occur over a few years. In the ancient world, what we just looked at would occur over a few centuries. Things used to change slowly. Now they change. By the time it's out on the shelves, they've already come up with another variation of it. So it's a different kind of world we live in. Pottery's great because it's found everywhere. It tells us a lot about things. So you say you find biblical passages that deal with pottery, like in Isaiah 45:9. And even Job used broken pottery to scrape himself, remember? Pottery could be used for all sorts of things. So you'll find plenty of pottery. By the way, most of the itty-bitty pieces of pottery you can pick up and take home. They want things that are intact, or at least partly so. So there are some limitations to some of these things, but I want to move to something very important here at the end, and I'll stop. The problem is the green shows us that all this portion is what's destroyed in antiquity, and what's preserved in these tales is a very small fraction. Then what happens, that very small fraction that's preserved in the tales, only a little small portion of that portion is recovered by archaeologists. And then of that which is recovered, only a little small portion of that is actually excavated scientifically. And last of all, even what you excavate properly published is very small. Matter of fact, sometimes some of the Dead Sea Scroll stuff they found in 48, it took 20 to 30 years to get it translated. People had to wait around while people held it in almost captivity as they worked on it. So it's really sort of a hard thing to move in archaeology. But we'll stop there. I've sort of introduced you to it, gave you a lot of it, little bits and pieces, and I hope this has been of some interest or help to you. This is the kind of stuff I like to do. That's why I do that study Bible that some of you have now, the HVSB, and House modestly named House Visual Study Bible, because that's what I try to do. You look at the text, and the stuff keeps coming to you to explain it visually, sometimes by photos, sometimes by video. So you may want to look at that. Okay, who's on next? Okay, let me get away.